Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads. Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, Mr. Dave Martino. Back in the house.
I'm back in the house.
I'm here.
Up from the basement of the House of Mystery.
Yeah. And don't think you're going too far. Just remember, you're back down in a short time.
That's right. Going back down into the darkness.
In the darkness. Well, you like that anyway. So listen, what's going on with Easter? Good Friday, Easter and all that stuff. What does the Martino family get up to? Big parties, lots of people.
I have to get my car fixed. Oh. Friday. Fun stuff.
And my wife just had had an abscess and had to have a root canal. So we're probably going to just take it easy.
Well, hopefully you're cooking dinner then.
Oh, of course.
Rubbing her feet.
It might just be like mashed potatoes and soft food. What about you, Al?
Well, I just work. I'm just going to be editing and writing and editing and right through the whole time until I start recording again next week. It's just
the way it goes. Yeah.
You know, I don't do anything on holidays. Bah humbug. It's wrong.
The hardest working man in radio.
Okay. Well, let's get right to it. We've got an interview with an author today. She's got a new book coming out here. It's April 2nd is the release date, and it's called Molten Death. It's an Orchid Isle mystery. So, Leslie Karst, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm happy to be part of the house.
Well, yeah, it's a good time for the most part, you know, as long as Dave doesn't get too wild. He can go crazy sometimes, you know. You know, especially if he starts drinking whiskey, it's bad. He puts on a
then
dress.
Forget about it.
Yeah, he's got a dress on and it's crazy, you know. Well, listen, so Leslie, let's talk about why you got into writing. Like what brought you into this world of writing? Was there like were you hurt badly as a child or something? Or
well, you know, it's interesting. I never, when I was in high school and junior high school, my friends were, you know, writing stories and stuff, and I never did any writing. But then I ended up being an English lit major in college, so then you have to do a lot of literary criticism, which I am not, I quickly realized that that wasn't my favorite thing in the world. But it did teach me to write coherent sentences. And the first time I did any kind of, I think what you'd call creative writing was after I graduated from college, I started a new wave rock and roll band, and I wrote songs for it. And I was also the lead singer and guitar, rhythm guitarist. And writing songs, you know, they're like little, I think now you'd call it flash fiction. They're little stories, you know, in how many, a couple hundred words. I loved it. I thought that was great. So then I dabbled in poetry, angst-ridden 20-something poetry. Then I realized I needed a real job because that rock and roll doesn't pay. And so I ended up going to law school and working as an attorney for 20 years. And lo and behold, I ended up being a research and appellate attorney, which means, guess what? You do a lot of writing, briefs and memos for the senior partners and whatnot. And again, not that fun, but it honed my craft of writing. Because, you know, you got to convince the judge to decide. You know, if you're writing a brief, the whole point of it is to convince the judge to decide in your favor. And so you have a set of facts and you have the law and you apply the facts to the law and you end up telling a story. And so I actually think writing those briefs kind of prepped me for writing mystery novels. Anyway, after I retired from the law, I realized I really liked writing, but I wanted to do something more fun. So I tried my hand at a mystery novel, and that's how I got started. Sort of a weird way to get into it, I guess.
Beginning of the end.
Yeah.
Did you find it difficult to make the transition from college writing and legal writing to the creative popular fiction type of writing?
I actually didn't. It was fun because I could be more playful. I did, you know, occasionally put playful things into my briefs because I figured if I were a judge, I'd get bored reading all this stuff. So I you can't be flippant though. So there's a fine line. But you know, what's interesting is that I realized that there was a lot of overlap between writing a legal brief and a murder mystery. and I wasn't even doing criminal law, but you know, you have to play fair with the reader, right? You know, if you're writing a brief, you can't put in false facts and you can't leave out important facts, or the opposing counsel will certainly point it out and you'll look like an idiot. And so that's the same thing with writing a mystery. You know, you can plant clues and red herrings, but you've got to play fair. You've got to have all the facts in, and you can't be lying but it's also how you place it. And if you can sort of hide them, you know, if I had a bad fact that I didn't really like, you know, you put it out there, but then you move on to something else very quickly. And that's what people do with red herrings or clues and mysteries. So I actually found that it helped, I think, which I would never have thought that, but there you go.
Well, and I noticed myself, even from true crime to writing into fiction now, that the advantage of fiction is you can actually get an outcome you like, or it can actually, you can serve justice, so to speak, as opposed to when you're writing something that's true, it is what it is. You don't get to put, you don't get to really say what happens, so to speak. It is what it is if you're doing facts, right?
Right. You have a set of facts but how you tell them is, you know, you can have a set of facts, and if you give it to six different attorneys, you're going to have six very different statement of facts, depending on which side you were on. Like if you have the same statement of facts, it's fascinating to read the plaintiff's version of the facts and the defendant's version of the facts. It's very interesting. You can learn a lot about writing by reading that. And they're the exact same facts as some set.
But I've got the best facts.
I've got the best facts.
Yeah, I guess it depends on who you're defending.
Yeah, there's that too.
Because law seems so rigid, you know? Seems so direct and cut and dry. So you do have a lot more room to move with.
It's actually
fiction.
Yeah, it's not that rigid. It's that's the reason it's scary when you have a case, because you don't know how it's going to end up, and you have a case law that, you know, so you're trying to find other cases that are similar to your cases, and so it's a little bit like a, you know, you're a detective going out there and trying to find these things. And and once you find a case that's similar to with your facts that is decided the way you want to, then it's like, eureka, that's the gold mine. And, but It is very fluid, more fluid now than it used to be in our Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah.
But
just look at politics.
Yeah, right. But the law, it isn't. It actually is. I mean, you have statutes that seem to be very specific, but oftentimes you can read it to mean one thing and read it to mean something else. And so people who are good with language and good at arguing make the best lawyers, because it's not cut and dry. It really depends on the advocate.
So now your new book here, Molten mm-hmm. Death, you call this is kind of a culinary mystery. What exactly, how do you describe this book? How is that?
Well, this book isn't as much of a culinary mystery as my previous series, which was the Sally Solari Culinary Mysteries. This one has, I'm obsessed with food, so there's a lot of food in it. but it's more of I'd say a travel mystery, or it's set in Hawaii, on the Big Island of Hawaii. And I like to call it a snarky cozy, because it's publishers classified as a cozy, which is sort of old school traditional mystery that doesn't have swearing in it. It doesn't have, a lot of graphic sex or graphic blood. And they tend to be lighter in tone. And mine are, my characters tend to be sort of snarky, so that's why I call them that.
Right.
But it's set on the Big Island of Hawaii, and it's a sort of a fish out of water story, because it's this couple, Kristen, or Valerie and her wife, Kristen, who are about 60 years old, come to the Big Island of Hawaii, and it's Valerie's first time there. And so part of the book is her just learning about Hawaii. Unfortunately for her, in chapter one of the first book, they hike out to see the current lava flow, and she alone sees what she thinks is a boot in the lava, and then she realizes to her horror that it's actually a leg, a human leg and body being covered over by the black, by the lava, and then it turns into black stone and it's gone, right? And they don't really believe her, the other people, and so she sets out to prove her sanity and to figure out the mystery of the body in the lava. And so, but she's never been to Hawaii before. So she, along with the reader, learns about this culture, which is very different from on the mainland.
So this is going to be a series as well, as just sort of like your last one. When you do a series like this, do you kind of know ahead of time, like how many you're going to have in this series? Do you kind of have kind of a main beginning and kind of where it's going to end, and you're just going to write your way to that? Or is this just completely ad-lib, one book at a time?
I think it really depends. I know there are people that have written what they thought were standalones, and then they're popular, and then they end up having to, oops, I guess I better make this into a series. So that's happened. With my Sally Solari series, I wanted to write five, because each one of them has sort of as an Easter egg. It's not really something you'd probably even notice if I didn't tell you, but for me, for my own pleasure, I made each one of them involves one of the human senses. And so I wanted to do the five senses. I ended up doing six, and so you can guess which that one is. With these Orchid Iron mysteries, I have a two-book contract right now, and I'm almost done writing the second one. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure how far it'll go at this point. I know how the second book is going, and I have an idea for a third book, but we'll see. I've become more of a pantser, seat of the pants writer, the more I get into this career.
Well, how do you keep track of your continuity in these books, in these series books? Do you have tools or a system, series
Bible? Yeah, a lot of people have series Bibles, and I should have one. It would sure make it a lot easier than having to go back and do word searches for what color was her car. Yes, the smart people have word Bibles. I mean, series Bibles. I have copious, some of them handwritten notes and files, and I go back, and I have a lot of, I do sort of treatments as I'm writing the book. So I have those for all the books, so I can go back and reread those. But yeah, continuity is a big deal. And I don't think I've messed up at this point, but if I have, I'm sure somebody will tell me.
Yeah, they always catch that.
They do.
They let you know. When you had this story, for instance, for Molten Death, or even your last series, is it the character or main characters maybe that you have first that you're starting to mm-hmm. get to know, and then you put them into the story? Or do you have this concept, like, did you have an idea of you wanted to do a mystery in Hawaii, and you kind of had the theme of what it was, and then you create the characters? Which came first for you?
Well, for the Sally Solari series, the Sally character absolutely came first. She's a fourth-generation Italian in Santa Cruz, California, where I live half-time when I'm not living in Hilo, Hawaii. And I knew I wanted to set a mystery in Santa Cruz. I knew I wanted it to involve this character that I came up with. And I knew that I wanted it to be about a restaurant, an Italian seafood restaurant. And then this other restaurant she inherits, which is more of a trendy restaurant. So that came first in that one. And for Molten Death, the setting and the event came first. I knew I'm kind of a lava junkie. I'm the sort of person that hike 10, 15 miles out to see hot flowing lava because it's so incredible. And I knew I wanted to have that be the focal point of the book, the lava. And so I came up with that first. And then the rest came, then the story and who they were and why they were there and what happened.
Did you throw someone in the lava to see what it would look like? Just, you know, someone you didn't like, just to see what, so you could describe it in the book, you know, and as they were sinking slowly.
I've never thrown a body in the lava, but then again, I've never had a body to throw in the lava. Now, I came up with this idea, and then afterwards I thought, you know, I bet that this isn't an original idea. I bet that there are a lot of bodies out there. It's the perfect place to hide a body because you would never, ever, it would be impossible to find it. And then I've heard tales that the Hawaiians before Western contact would actually, I don't know if they buried bodies in the lava, but I mean, it was part of their culture too, to maybe, I don't know, prisoners, opposing warriors, I'm not sure, but I bet if you could have some sort of an infrared that saw down into that black rock, you'd see a lot of skeletons. Maybe that's just my crime writing addled brain, though.
No, it wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me at all. You know, humans, the longer I've lived, the more I realize that things no longer take me by surprise anymore. Yeah. It just happens, you know. You learn crazy stuff, so it doesn't end. Right. So your characters, what's your relationship with your characters, like your main characters? So, for instance, with this one here, Valerie, mm-hmm. and yourself, how do you feel about your character? Are they like a sister, a daughter, a friend, a person, or do you have no relationship?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Maybe a sister. I mean, this Sally is a lot younger than I am. Valerie is turned 60 during the book, and so she's closer to my age. And she's also a lesbian, and as am I, and which was wonderful to get to write that as characters, because there was a period, it's only been pretty recently, that I would have been able to get this book published as a cozy mystery, which is terrific. I'm very, very proud of our crime writing community and the publisher, and my publisher's awesome, Severn House. I want to give them a shout out. Yeah, I do have, I do feel a connection to her. Of course, I would never, ever become a private, an amateur sleuth because I'm way too chicken. I would run away. If I saw a body, I would turn and run away and call the cops. So I'm not a bit like her. But yeah, we share a fair amount in common. We both love food. We both love Hawaii.
Well, there you go. Food in Hawaii is what your favorite things, eh?
But yeah, actually, I like that. I had never thought about that before. But yeah, I would like her as my sister. That would be fun. I happen to have a very great sister, but she would be a good second one.
Well, speaking of your characters, do you hear your characters when you're writing? And do you even hear the prose? Do you have an inner monologue? Because not everybody has that. And is that how you create dialogue?
Absolutely. I love writing dialogue, and it's my favorite part of writing because I love language and I love listening to to people speak. One of the things I do when I'm on my bicycle rides is I'll ride slowly by. There's this place here in Santa Cruz called Westcliff Drive where people walk their dogs and strollers and stuff. And I'll cruise by and listen to conversations and get ideas for dialogue in my books. And the way one thing they talk about, and you know, when you're studying the craft of fiction writing, is that you should be able to differentiate your different characters, even if you don't have dialogue tags, meaning, you know, he said, she said, by their language being different. Now, of course, people who in the same community often sound a lot alike, but it's fun to play with that. Like one of my characters in Molten Death is a local boy, Isaac. And he, like many of the people in Hilo, Hawaii, he is fluent in the local pidgin, but he also speaks perfect standard English and switches freely back and forth between them. And the pidgin is a connecting device that the people who live there, if you speak pidgin together, you know that you're coming from the same place and you share this culture, and it's very much of a bonding thing. And so, and he talks a little bit about it in the book, and that was fun, but difficult. And I didn't want to blow it, so I had some people who speak pidgin read it to make sure I wasn't embarrassing myself. But that was really fun. That's an exaggerated version of it, but just having slightly, you know, some person uses this phrase over and over again or whatever. And yeah, that's, I love it. I love writing the dialogue.
Well, what happens to your character when the book ends, like when the series ends, like your last series with Sally? So is Sally gone now? Do you ever hear that character again, or is it, what's your experience?
Oh, I hope she's okay. I mean, when I last left her, she was doing just fine. You know, you can ask the same question about them before it starts, right? You know, it's like a slice of their life, these books. Now you've made me feel bad that I've left her alone out there in some sort of...
You've just left?
Left her out there in limbo somewhere.
Used her and that's it. You're done.
I do think about her a lot, though, because she over the course of six books, I became very close to her. I actually once, speaking of my sister, I was with her in our dogs down at the beach here in Santa Cruz once, many, you know, 5 years ago, probably. And I forget exactly what the conversation was about, but she asked me a question, and I didn't say it out loud, thank goodness, but I thought to myself, oh, I can ask Sally. And I actually thought that, and then went, whoa, maybe I need to, you know, go to a psychiatrist. Yeah. But it was very odd because she had become so close to me.
Right. That's strange. They, you know, they'll take away your driver's license. It's like, you know, that's crazy. Hey, and you got a Jack Russell too?
She is. She's a half Jack, we think. Yes, accent. I don't know. You know, she's a Punatic. She's from Puna in Hawaii, and we got her as a puppy. And we did. We got to meet her parents. She's a what they call a poi dog, a mixed breed. But she, based on her parents, we're guessing that she's half Jack Russell, a quarter corgi, and she has big time corgi ears, and a quarter chihuahua, which, as far as I'm concerned, the only redeeming quality of that is that it makes her small, because we carry her on the airplane. She can go in the cabin because she's small with us. And but I'd say her personality is mostly Jack Russell. She's feisty.
Yeah. Well, Oscar, I got a 19-year-old Jack Russell.
You do? Oh, I'm so happy to hear that, because Ziggy just turned 13, and I worry she's getting old. 19.
No, they keep ticking. Most dogs that age, you know, 14 or 15, but this one, like he turned 19 back in January, and he can still do everything that he's got a chronic bronchitis now that he takes medicine for every day, a pill.
Is he pure, Jack? But,
yeah, we think so. Again, because we get rescues from the pound that are usually older, like, you know, five plus when we get them. And they're usually Chihuahuas, and Jack Russells are the most, because we only get smaller to medium, you know. And so he certainly looks like he's pretty pure. He, you know, he might have something else in him, but can't tell.
I wanted a Jack Russell ever since the TV show Frasier.
Yeah, they're good. They're good dogs. Or, I mean, once they, you know, they're good.
For our listeners out there in Radioland, don't get a Jack Russell unless you really have a lot of time to spend with them. They're very high maintenance, and they'll be unhappy if you don't, you know. She was young, first 5 years, needed a lot of attention, and they're very demanding. And they will bark at you if you don't do what they say.
Yeah, and he's still that way at 19.
Yep.
He's still, he'll come over, and then he just, he doesn't bark now, but he does this big, you know, huff.
And
stand there and look at you. You know, it's like, holy cow, I guess that means you need something, hey? You know, he's a character. But yeah, they're good dogs. Good dogs. I like that. Well, back to the book. So you were saying, okay, so like you said, you got really close to your character, like your last one, Sally, and over six books and however many years and stuff like that. So you go through a lot with this character and putting them through a lot. Do you think that changes you too as a person?
Ooh, you're asking hard questions. Does it change? I mean, I will say that it's hard. The more I got to know Sally, the worse I felt putting her through these things that you do to your characters in the books, because, you know, if their life is just happy and simple, it's not much of a book to read. And sometimes I would do these things to her and I'd feel really bad. So, so has it changed?
Well, I look at it this way. You see, it's almost like they become a friend, or like you said, your sister or family. They become very close to you, and you're not just doing one book, but you go through six, and so it's probably at least 6 years. Yeah. And something happens to them in a way you feel it too. Do you know what I mean?
Like, no, I do. I mean, I do. I remember writing one particular scene where I put her in danger, and she was really scared, and I was hyperventilating as I was typing. I mean, and sweating, and I mean, because I felt like it was happening to me.
Right. And that's what I mean. So that doing that for a period of years with one person, one character, so to speak, it's got to make some changes in you. It almost like if it really happened to a friend, you know?
Or it's a little bit like you're having a Vulcan mind meld and Sally and I become one.
Well, yeah, but it's something I ask a lot of writers, because I think that it's a really interesting concept, especially when you're with a character for so many books and you put them through so much.
Right.
Because in order to write a good book, you kind of feel what they're going through. Do you know what I mean?
You have to. Yeah, no, I think you have to feel it emotionally. If you don't feel emotionally hopefully I'm not feeling emotionally what my killers are feeling.
No. Well, we'll get to that later.
But for the protagonist in particular, yes, you do. It's not going to come across as being real. And it's not going to be emotionally meaningful to the reader if it isn't emotionally meaningful to you, the writer.
That's right. It's got to have that realness to it. And it comes from your own feeling. That's what I mean. So I just think, in a sense, you're kind of like living with this other group of people or characters, and in a way you're kind of emotionally attached to them because you're going through all these things. It was always something to
think
about.
Well, now you're making me feel really happy that I chose as my genre to have the lighter toned mysteries, because, you know, if you're writing thrillers and domestic suspense, I personally don't want to be living that day after day.
Yeah, and it's hard, because even when I've been through true crime, and you go through, especially when people are still alive and survivors. Absolutely. And stuff, and you're talking with them and you're spending time with them over a bit of a year, you start to really feel their agony or pain or stress or whatever it is, because it's pretty emotional, right?
Very much so. I started out in my third year of law school. I did an internship with the Santa Cruz Public Defender, and it was really a great experience. And those attorneys they're still a lot of them good friends of mine. But I found it, since you're dealing with people's lives, you know, if you blow it, they're going to go to jail for the rest of their life, prison. I took it home at night. I couldn't sleep at night. I was so worried about my cases and the people I was defending. That I realized after that semester, I needed to go into civil law where it was just money involved. Because, yeah, I really, really felt it. It's, I mean, I guess that's the sign of somebody who cares. But at the same time, I have great admiration for people who can do that for many years.
Yeah, it's a lot of, you have to put a lot into it. That's what, but, you know, that's kind of what, you know, it's a good thing, I think. But, so are you, when you're writing something like this in any of these mysteries, is it pure entertainment then, or do you actually have a subtext, or is there a meaning or something you want a reader to take away besides?
No, I absolutely, all of my books have, I don't get what I, you know, political, I'm right. Making little air quotes as I say that. You don't want, nobody wants to read a book and be lectured to. But for instance, okay, for my Sally Solari books, they're set largely in the restaurant business. And I do have a degree in culinary arts, which I got while I was working as an attorney. And I know for a fact, having worked in many restaurants, both front of the house and back of the house, it's a grueling job, and there are a lot of problems with it. I mean, there's sexism, there's racism in kitchens, there are issues with immigration and federal agents coming into kitchens and arresting people, all sorts of these very, very real world issues that happen in restaurants. And I did not want to ignore that because it would be completely unrealistic. And so all of my books touch a little bit on the real world. And the most recent one, there's a subtext about the homeless, because since Santa Cruz is in many places, it's a real issue here. There are all sorts of people that without homes, and it's horrible. It's so sad to see it. And there's no great answer. People are constantly, and both the, you know, everybody's fighting about different, everybody wants to help them, but they're have completely different ideas of how to go about doing it. So I've worked that in as a sort of a subplot in the book. At the same time, it's still a light read. But there's that, yes, subtext, as you say, in there. And then in the new book, in Molten Death, there are a lot of political hot issues happening in Hawaii for obvious reasons. The fact that the government was overthrown illegally, in my opinion, by the United States. And now with the sovereignty movement, is very coming back very much, especially on the Big Island. And I don't talk a lot about, you know, who's right or who's wrong. I present both sides of some of these issues, and I just have the characters speak for themselves. But it is something that is at issue on the island. And if you spend any time there, it's going to come up in conversation. And so there is a little bit of that. It's not, you know, it's not the whole book at all, but it comes into the plot in bits and pieces.
Well, it kind of has to, because it represents the time and where you're at, the place, and it makes it more real, right?
Right, exactly. So, it's not real otherwise, yeah, if you just ignore all that. It's like Disneyland, which is fun.
Yeah. No, it just becomes more of a fantasy.
Exactly.
And then, you know, it takes away from a mystery. Mm-hmm.
So right, right.
And now, so I guess being in Hawaii and your character of the setting, it must, you know, you must write your setting as if it is a real character, sort of.
Very much so. I consider both my settings, Santa Cruz and Hilo, or the Big Island, as absolutely characters in the book, because I love both places so very much. And it was really fun writing this first Orchid Isle mystery, because I felt like I was showing everybody all the reasons I love it so much, you know, the murder notwithstanding. And that's one of the reasons I chose to make it a fish out of water story, because Valerie is from Los Angeles. And so she gets to learn about it along with the reader. And also, it's not my place to tell a Hawaiian's story. I didn't grow up there. The setting is, I mean, especially given the, you know, molten death, it's about, you know, a volcanic eruption. Can't have more setting than that.
No, but I mean, so what do you think the general public, people might not understand about Hawaii? Like, what is it that someone's never been to Hawaii that's an American or Canadian or whatever? And so what do you think the real Hawaii is compared to maybe what people think?
Well, the history, which I touched on, the fact that it was taken over by the United States. And so that there's that. So it's a little, and as me as a Howley, you know, a Westerner, you know, you always feel a little bad about that, because it's, you know, it was wrong what we did. But at the same time, you're not going to go back now. It's impossible. And so what you've got to do is just sort of, be nice and gracious and not be a jerk. You know, I think the biggest thing is a lot of times people just expect white sand beaches and Mai Tais and cocoa palms and trade winds and Hawaiian music. And yeah, all those things are there, and they're beautiful and they're wonderful. But that's just part of it. There's also, the Big Island of Hawaii is largely just black rock because it's an active, it's, there are three active volcanoes on the island. And, you know, it's, so it's different. It's, you know, the famous thing is people fly into Kailua Kona for the first time and it looks like a moonscape and they're like, what the heck? And there's, you know, Hilo, which is where I live half time, which is on the windward side of the Big Island. So it's on the opposite side from Kona. And so it's very wet. It's in fact the wettest, it's the second rainiest city in the United States. Ketchikan, Alaska is the number one, but anyway, but it's a lot warmer, so it's nice. And so people don't expect that. And I think a lot of times people don't expect it just to be a real, I mean, because they do think of it as if all you've seen is movies that are set there, you don't really think about the fact that, no, this is a really, there's community here. People live here. They work here. They go to school here. And
It's not fantasy island.
Right. It's not fantasy island. Although if you go to some of the big hotels or the resorts and that's all you do is stay there, then it is. And you'll never, ever see that other, the real Hawaii. I mean, that's real. I mean, I'm not going to say that the resorts are real Hawaii. They're just only a very small part of it. And goodness, you know, they make up for a lot of the employment on the Big Island. Many people commute over to that side to work in the hotels.
What's next for Leslie? What do you got in the go now?
Well, I'm writing book two in the Orchid Isle series, which is called Waters of Destruction. And in this book, Valerie and Kristen have moved to the Big Island because you can't have a series set there if they're not there. Waters of Destruction, the name of the river that flows through Hilo, and it divides the volcanoes of Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa, is called the Wailuku River. And in Hawaiian, that means Waters of Destruction because it's a very dangerous river. People drown in it all the time. I mean, several a year. And because there are lava tubes that are in it and they suck people in and it's this really creepy thing. And I read about that and I said, oh, that's perfect for a mystery novel. so that's basically my full attention, other than, you know, doing publicity for this new book. Thank you very much for calling me today.
And I was going to say, do you find it hard to do kind of two at the same time? Because quite often, by the time the book's out, you're already on your new one. You know,
it is confusing. And as somebody asked me a question the other day about the book that's coming out next week, Molten Death, and I started to answer with a question about the one I'm writing right now, and then I had to stop myself and go, no, that plot point isn't in that book. So yeah, it is confusing. luckily, I'm not having to. I'm not talking too much about the one I'm writing right now. I don't have to talk about it. So, but I do. Yes, it's hard to keep your focus. And then simultaneously, the last of my Sally Solari books, A Sense for Murder, is up for the Lefty Award at the Left Coast Crime, which is happening in a few weeks. So people are also asking me about that. So I've got those three books to talk about. And so it's confusing.
Busy. So how do you take on a bad character, the one that does the murder or does the bad thing in each of your
bad books? I think I'm a people pleasing person, and so for me I think that is the hardest part. The good thing is that with this subgenre that I write in, which is the lighter mysteries, the traditional slash cozy, the bad characters don't tend to be serial killers or you know, arch evil people. They tend to just be somebody in the community that has had something go horribly wrong in their life, or they've just lost it for a moment or whatever, and that's where the murder happens. Because one of the things about that makes these books fit into the genre they are is that the amateur sleuth is out and about in the community, and it's those people who are the suspects. So I luckily don't have, I don't think I could write a serial killer. It would just creep me out too much. But even though, and it's hard, and then of course you have to, you know, you're going to, you want to have anywhere between 3 and 5 at the most suspects, because it gets too confusing. But if you have less than 3, it's too easy. And you want them all to be credible suspects. And so if you make, I mean, you could make one a really horrible person. And then if they are the killer, then it's like, well, that was obvious. And if they aren't the killer. It's like a little bit like, well, you really, that was kind of annoying that you did that. So you sort of want to balance them all out. So everybody has flaws. Everybody has secrets, in it, you know, of the suspects. And so you don't tend to find out just how horrible they are till the last third of the book. So I don't have to do it too much, thank goodness.
Yeah, you don't find out how bad Dave is until the end. Then we know. So listen, do you like interacting with readers? And do you have like social media set up for them? Do you have a website? How do people get a hold of Leslie?
I love interacting with readers. It's one of my favorite things about this vocation is getting to talk to people at mystery conventions, or if they write me emails. I love it. I love chatting with people via email. I do have a website. It's lesliekarstauthor.com. And if you just Google my name, it comes up right away. And I have, I'm on two different group blogs, which are lots of fun. Chicks on the Case. There are, what, 8 of us now, I think. And we blog every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And it tends to be a lighthearted blogs about, we mostly write lighthearted mysteries. And we have guest bloggers. And so that's a lot of fun. And they become like family with me. All the gals and chicks on the case, all the chicks. And then I also blog with Mystery Lover's Kitchen, which posts a recipe every day of the year. And and we're all mystery writers who write a lot about food and cooking. And so you can follow me on either of those, Mystery Lover's Kitchen or Chicks on the Case. And I'm on Facebook and Instagram, so you can find me there. And I will be at Left Coast Crime, which is coming up on April 11th, I believe it starts, in Seattle, well, Bellevue, Washington. And then I'll be at Wallace Domestic, which is, I love that, it's got to be the greatest title for a mystery convention, which is in Bethesda, Washington, D.C., it's the very end of April. And then there's the BoucherCon Mystery Conference, which I'll be at, and it's in Nashville this year, which is, I believe, the end of September.
You're busy.
I am. I'm very busy, and I just got back from Hawaii yesterday. Yikes!
Well, you mentioned recipes just a minute ago, and you know, since this book is a cozy culinary mystery, what's your favorite Hawaiian recipe?
Ooh, you know, one of my favorite things is poke, which is really easy to make, actually. Which is it's raw fish, generally ahi tuna, although you can make it out of other kinds of fish, salmon, octopus, mussels. You can make vegetarian poke out of breadfruit or, you know, vegetables, string beans. But the ahi tuna kind, which is the most prevalent, is you cut it up into bite-sized pieces. Actually, there's a recipe for this in my book. Marinated in their variety of different styles, but a lot of them involve soy sauce and sesame oil, toasted sesame oil, a little maybe seaweed. Sometimes they have sriracha mayonnaise. And it's just delicious. It's very good with crackers, or it's traditionally eaten in a poke bowl over steamed rice, but I like to eat it with potato chips.
Oh, very good.
That's delicious.
And ahi tuna is so cheap and so fresh there on the islands. It's just wonderful.
Well, this is great. So now the book, Molten Death, an Orchid Isle Mystery. And our guest is the writer of that and many others. So, Leslie Karst, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Dave and Al. It's a pleasure talking with you. You know, we'll have to get together for cocktails sometime.
Absolutely. Thanks, Leslie.
This has been a production of the House of Mystery Radio Show. To find out more about our show, guests, or hosts, go to our website at houseofmysteryradio.com.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery Radio Show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.